Actually, Doug, I prefer you give me the words because Wendell's not speaking today. The topic for today is the passage of 1 Corinthians on head coverings. And when Wendell asked a month or so ago if he could announce the topic, I said, sure, as long as you're sensitive enough not to call it Burka Sunday. It may seem a strange issue to discuss. However, at the time we had our discussions on women in ministry, a year ago or so, actually maybe a couple years ago, time flies. A number of questions on this issue came up at the time, and we said we would address it later, and this is actually the first opportunity we've had to spend time on it. In addition, of course, there are groups within the Christian community who do advocate the wearing of head coverings. The Apostolic Church, most of you are probably familiar with. There are some Pentecostal groups that have a take on this particular passage as well. For those of you who find the topic totally uninteresting, though, you might consider this a treatise or a exercise in hermeneutics, how to deal with difficult passages, because that's certainly what this passage is. I don't have slides on this today, so it'd be really helpful if you'd turn to it in your Bible, and you want to keep it open so that you can refer to it as we go along. It's 1 Corinthians 11. We're going to start in verse 3. 1 Corinthians 11, starting in verse 3. And I'm going to read from the NIV. You'll notice significant differences if you have another version, like the New English Bible or the King James or any number of other translations that treat this passage somewhat differently. So you might pay attention to those differences as we go along. We'll revisit some of them. Now I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head, and every woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head. It is just as though her head were shaved. If a woman does not cover her head, she should have her hair cut off. And if it is a disgrace for a woman to have her hair cut or shaved off, she should cover her head. A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man did not come from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. For this reason, and because of the angels, the woman ought to have a sign of authority on her head. In the Lord, however, woman is not independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as woman came from man, so also man is born of woman, but everything comes from God. Judge for yourselves, is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a disgrace to him? But that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory. For long hair is given to her as a covering. If anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. Now, as you read it in the NIV there, it sounds fairly straightforward. But, of course, there are, as I say, significant differences in the way people interpret this passage. And in fact, as I did research on this, I saw a particular journal that documented 22 distinct different positions that Christians have held on this passage. And such a scholar as D.A. Carson is probably the best scholar evangelicals have. I heard him refer to this passage one time, and he said something about head coverings, whatever that should mean. Even D.A. Carson, who, as I say, is probably the top man when it comes to evangelicals and New Testament studies, was not willing, at least at that point, to take a judged position on it. What I'd like to do is look at some of these 22 different elements in this passage that are up for discussion, and we'll sort of do a quick survey of that. So this will get rather tedious as we go along. I'll try not to go into exhaustive detail in each one, but I want to cover some of the differences so you can see what we're dealing with in the passage. The passage is, of course, itself part of an occasional letter. A letter that Paul is responding to specific incidences and events that are happening in the Corinthian community, the church community there, and he's responding to them. And we don't have both sides of the conversation. We only have one side of the conversation. We have Paul's response to whatever's going on there. And so you have to sort of extrapolate then what the problem is. And if it's not real clear, then you get difficulty. For example, in later in the same chapter in 11, he talks about communion. And we know from the solution there what he's talking about. If we didn't have that solution spelled out, we might think of something different. And those of you who heard Wendell speak on this will know that know what I'm talking about there. But in this particular case, the solution doesn't define the problem as well as it does elsewhere in the passage. So let's look at some of the things that are up for dispute in today's discussion. The first one is, of course, how the term head is used here. In classical Greek, the word that's translated here as head meant origin. And so is the passage saying, I want you to realize that the origin of every man is Christ and the origin of every woman, or is he talking about head in the sense of authority? And there's been a raging discussion for the last 20 years on this, and there's good arguments to be marshaled for each side. So you do have those people who are arguing that what you're dealing with here is the chain of sort of structure in terms of creation. The problem with that is, of course, how does, in that context, how is God the head of Christ? And you get into some theological discussion with that. So even foundationally on the term head, which runs throughout this passage, there's debate of the significant nature. I don't think that's an insurmountable problem, though, because the two terms can be tied together. If you think in terms of origins, you could also think in terms of a hierarchy of sorts, because you do have in the classical Middle Eastern concept, the older as having a place of higher honor than the younger, and therefore the order of creation would be important in that. But anyway, it is a problem that is widely discussed on people who take different positions on this end up with a different solution. Second is the term man and woman there at the beginning in the first few verses. The word in Greek for man and woman is the same words that are used for husband and wife. So is this talking about relationship between a husband and wife, or is it saying all men are the head of all women? And how you answer that question will determine very much what you are seeing in this passage. As I mentioned, if you go that route also, the head of Christ is God, what does that mean? If it's an origin, did Christ originate in God? That would make him a created being in the similar of Jehovah's Witnesses. I mean, you get all sorts of difficulty if you follow through that particular pattern. Then there's the issue in verses 4 through 7 of what does covered and uncovered mean? A lot of people think that what's being talked about here is a veil, a full facial veil. Some people think it's like a shawl. There are church groups that have just any sort of small covering that could go over the head would work. There are people who think that this is the length of hair. In fact, I think the King James version would lend you to believe that would be the case, that it's talking about long hair as opposed to short hair. And there's a good case to be made for it talking about hairstyle. That may seem odd, but the term there that's used for uncovered there is the same term that's used for the bitter water rite in the Old Testament, where the woman was suspected of adultery and it wasn't sure. She hadn't been caught in the act. It wasn't witnessed. Her hair was to be loosened and let flow freely during this bitter water rite until she was found to be either innocent or guilty. And the Greek word that's used in the Septuagint for that is the same word that's used here. So although we would think of it as an external covering, in fact, it's clear that the word can be used for unbinding or loosening the hair. And therefore, there is a good case to be made for the fact that this is a particular type of hairstyle, the binding of the hair. In addition, of course, you have several instructions in the New Testament where it talks about women not braiding their hair or wearing jewels in their hair. And if you're talking about a full hair covering, then that would seem to be something that wouldn't be seen anyway. However, if it's dealing with hairstyle, then it would be something that would be seen. So a strong case could be made for any one of those positions, and they are. In fact, if you look at modern translations, you'll find very often that the translation will take one approach in the text, and then they'll have an alternate reading in the footnotes. You do that with the NIV, and I think the English Standard Version does that as well. The term, again, that is used here for covered and uncovered literally means having down from the head. It can be used of shawls, it can be used of turbans, but it can, as I say, be used of hair that's just been loosed. So it's very difficult from that to determine what's being used in this context. The term veil is only used once in this, and that's down in verse 15. And we'll talk about that a little later on. That's the only place where the word veil appears. In terms of custom, you know, look to see what the customs were of the first century. That's not really of any help because you always have to make sure you're dealing with the same cultural, social setting and also at the same time frame. So there have been all sorts of people that have looked at this passage and done extensive surveys through ancient literature to find out what sort of head covering was being talked about. But most of them deal with either the Greek or Roman culture, and it's 200 years earlier or 100 years later. A few of them will talk about the Jewish practice. The Jewish practice is from the time after the destruction of Jerusalem, when the Pharisaical form of Judaism is the one that becomes predominant. So none of those help in any way. It does give us an idea of some of the different variants of hairstyle in the time, but it doesn't pin down what he's talking about here. So custom is not really of any help when you look at the historical setting. And as I said, the same number or the same word is used for the loosening of the hair in Numbers 5:18, and there's at least one version of the Septuagint that uses it for the fact that lepers aren't supposed to cover themselves. And so, there, again, we have quite a range of the way that the Jews use that particular term in their translation from the Greek or to the Greek. Then we have a question of image and glory. Why is it start down the line of man being the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man? Does he mean to imply there that a woman is not created in the image, which would be contradictory to Genesis 1? Obviously, that's not the case there, but it has been pointed out as a problem for many of the people attempting to interpret this passage. One of the big ones is in verse 10, because of the angels. What does that mean? And frankly, there's just a few options, and although this seems a little bit vague, the options most often given are that the angels were observers of order in worship, according to ancient Jewish literature. There's been a great deal of work done in this on the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essene community, where they have an elaborate scheme where the angels are the observers of propriety among the congregation. And there's a possibility that that's what Paul's is talking about here. Sometimes you hear mentioned the idea that it's referring to angels lusting after women because of their long hair. That goes back to the rather bizarre intertestament idea that the angels in Genesis 6 intermingled and created offspring with humans. That's not a position that we're apt to buy into here at the Church of the Lamb. And in fact, most scholars will point out the impossibility of it from what we know of angelic beings. Then verse 10 also is the phrase in the NIV called sign of authority, or it says sign of authority. This is a sign of her authority or sign of authority. Sign doesn't occur in the original Greek. It's authority. And so are they saying that it's something that represents the actual authority you have, or is it some sort of sign or symbol of authority? And most modern interpreters take, or translators at least, take it to be the sign of authority or symbol of authority. But as I say, it's not in the text. And if you take it in the way that the modern text gives it, it treats it in sort of a passive sense, that the woman has this over her head. It doesn't come from her. It's not her own authority. It's authority sort of imposed on her or given to her from outside or external sources. But in fact, the word, that very same word is used 9 other times in Corinthians, and it's all in an active sense rather than a passive tense. So in other words, it would imply that the woman has authority over her own head, has her own authority. And In fact, 109 times that the word occurs in the Septuagint, the Philo, the early Hellenistic Jewish author of the first century, and Josephus. It occurs 109 times in those three collections of material, and not one time is it passive. It's always active. So it would seem the best translation for this is not to use the term sign of. William Ramsey, the great classical scholar of Christianity, many years ago, around the turn of the century, this would be the 19th to the 20th century, William Ramsey said it's a preposterous idea to translate it this way, sign of. It's a preposterous idea which a Greek scholar would laugh at anywhere except in the New Testament, whereas they seem to think Greek words mean anything commentators choose. He's saying, look, if you took this in a normal Greek passage, there's no one that would put it in a passive sense. It would all be in an active sense. It wouldn't be authority from without that's reflected in her head covering. It would be her authority. She has authority in and of herself. The next variable that's talked about a lot, I'm going through these rather rapidly, and you'll see the reason why I'm not exhausting the topic each time I look at one of these will come later. But the next one that we want to look at is in verse 11. In the NIV, it's in the Lord, however, woman is not independent of man. The however there is very emphatic in the Greek, and normally it would mean something that's contrasted to change of direction of subject. So we're going this way, now we're going to change directions and go this way. And in that sense, it would imply that he's having now some divergence from where he was headed. He's arguing to a certain way, and now he's going to change and argue a different way. And you get a little bit of that in English, because now he's coming back and saying, you know, if he's argued for any sort of chain of authority or hierarchy prior to this, he's now saying, but remember, however, that in the Lord, this isn't the case, that we're independent, that we're not independent, that we're interdependent with each other. And some people make more of that than others, because they do argue that he is actually changing his mind in the text and heading off in a different direction now. There's no reason to assume that that is necessarily the case. Then the issue in verse 10 also is... verse 14. Does not the very nature of things teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace to him? What does he mean by nature there? Does he mean nature in the sense of sort of an inviolable law of nature? Or does he mean it's just look around you, isn't it sort of the way things are? And one of them would have a little more authority than the other. One of them would be an appeal to something that's inviolable. The other one would be an appeal to something that's just look at the custom around you. Isn't it the truth that this is the practice? Verse 15. But that if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for long hair is given to her as a covering. What's translated there as in the NIV is actually, again, a word that generally means in the Greek instead of or in place of. And if you read it that way, it would say, but long hair is given to her in place of a covering. And that would imply something different again, because he's saying you wouldn't need an external covering because her long hair is given to her in place of that. And finally, in verse 16, if anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice. The word that the NIV translates other there is no such practice. And, of course, the idea is what's the referent to there? What's the such practice that he's talking about? The people that don't want to obey, or the people that do want to obey the idea of that Paul's trying to get across here. Some people think that he's sort of saying, well, look, if anyone's to be contentious about this, we haven't really established any practice that we need to enforce. Or is he saying, if anyone wants to be contentious about this, we have no other practice than the one that I've just given you? Which seems to be, I think, a better possibility in the context. Now, you can see from just that quick survey that I've done the number of different things that are up for discussion. Some of them are fairly easy to solve. Some of them are quite difficult. And, in fact, if you look at church history, you'll find it's been presented in a number of different ways throughout church history. There's no one single position on this. But despite the fact that we have these 22 different documented interpretations in commentaries today, almost all of them agree on the conclusion, which is that head coverings aren't to be practiced in churches today, that there's no practice of covering the head that's universal in all times and all places. Now, why is it that they can have so many variations on what the passage actually says, and whether it's talking about external coverings or whether it's talking about long hair, or whether it's talking about braided hair or whatever, and yet still come to the same conclusion with one or two exceptions? And the reason is because when we look at a passage, we look to see if there are commands that are universals or if there are commands that have a universal but then are implemented or demonstrated in a way that's relative to the culture. So, for example, not every command that's given in Scripture is a command you can apply to yourself. We don't, for example, think that because Abraham was commanded to sacrifice Isaac that we should go out and try and sacrifice our offspring. We understand that that's a command given to a specific situation, to a specific person. We generally don't practice in most churches foot washing. The reason we don't is because we understand that the cultural practice that has an important purpose in that time, when you're wearing sandals and running around the dusty side, you do need your feet washed. And Jesus is using that foot washing, which is a common practice, as a sign of servanthood. And so it's the servanthood that's important. It's not the actual practice of washing feet. Most churches, other than the Apostolic Church, believe that greeting one another with a holy kiss is relative. That because they would kiss each other on the cheek as a greeting in that particular time frame doesn't mean that every culture in every world should kiss each other on the cheek as a greeting. We quite willingly substitute a handshake for that. So the issue when you look at a passage of this is you look at whether there's a universal express that's meant to be practiced a particular way through all times, or is there a universal express that has a relative practice associated with it that might change from culture to culture. And a lot of times when you look at universals, you're looking for things where it's rooted in the creation or in the character of God. And it does look like he has an argument here related to creation. He appeals to the order of creation. However, is there anything in that order that then demands a head covering? Would you naturally assume, okay, here's the difference, there's got to be a head covering involved? Well, no. Is it a universal practice in terms of the understanding of godly people throughout history? Well, no, because there are certainly differences in practice throughout even the Old Testament. And in fact, in the Old Testament, God commands the priest who's serving in the temple to wear a turban or a mitre. He specifically gives that instruction. So here you have a case where God's commanding that a man in service to God in the worship wear a head covering. So if he's arguing that it's forever wrong for a man to have a head covering, then you've got a problem up front, because it's certainly something he instructed that when encounter that in the Old Testament. If it were dealing with long hair, is it true that that's a universal, that men have always had shorter hair than women? Well, again, you have within Scripture at least several examples where that wasn't the case, among them the Nazarites, who when they sanctify themselves and set themselves apart for a period of time, one of the things they do is not cut their hair during that period and let their hair grow long. They don't let a razor touch it at all. And in fact, Paul in Acts apparently has taken that type of vow, because it talks about at the end of his vow period, he goes to get his hair cut and trimmed back because it's grown long. So in all these cases, it seems like there's no universal practice that automatically is assumed because of the order of creation that's given here. What you do have is a distinction made between man and woman, and man as the head in both the church and in the marital relationship. And so most commentators agree that what's important here is to maintain the gender distinction, and that the woman not be seen as in rebellion against the created order. And so the way we express that would be different in different cultures. And in fact, the mere fact that you wore a head covering wouldn't say that to the culture around you, which is one of the things Paul's interested in here. So if you trace that through and you look at the practice actually in the the Old Testament in particular here, you'll find that there's no consistent understanding that a woman was to be covered because of the order of creation. You also have no commandment given for that until Paul speaks of this particular incident here. And so the assumption is from those two principles that there is no absolute universal practice prescribed here, but there is a universal principle, and the universal principle can be expressed in different ways. As Hurley says, head coverings were at issue in 1 Corinthians 11. In the first century, these were understood as having to do with woman's origin from man. They were a sign of her relationship to his authority. This remains the case whether we conclude that Paul was talking about veils or lengths or styles of woman's hair. What he's saying there is the reason we can come to this similar conclusion here, whether you're dealing with long hair or covering or veils or whatever, is that he's talking about a particular way that the relationship between men and women was being perceived in the time at Corinth there. Does a woman wearing a veil have significance for worship anywhere today? Well, in those churches where they practice it, apparently it does, but it doesn't say that to the person outside observing. You wouldn't see somebody with a veil and go, oh yes, she's being submissive to her husband. You would just say, well, that's an unusual practice. So it seems from that the principle being talked about here is something other than the specific practice. And in fact, if you look at the rest of Corinthians, you'll find that Paul deals with issues that are related to this. There is, among the Corinthians, the idea of a realized eschatology, the idea that the resurrection has already occurred. And the way this practiced is through dissolving the marital relationship, not having sex anymore because you're above that as an angelic being. All of these things are referred to in Corinthians, including in 15, where he talks about the people there that are totally misguided and believe the resurrection has already occurred. And so what you probably have in this situation is a blurring of the gender issue with this idea that there's a realized eschatology and we all really have become like the angels, and therefore no distinction is necessary in our culture to preserve this identity between man and woman. So the equivalent practice today would be to undress in appearance, make sure that there's a distinction between male and female, and that in the husband or wife relationship, that the headship of the husband is not ignored or despised, but preserved and kept intact. And so there are different ways in different cultures to do that. In our culture, there are a lot of different things that have been suggested to replace this, but most appropriately, I think, is the distinction of not attempting to blur the gender, to be male and female, and to not blur that distinction through either dress or behavior. And it doesn't mean, though, that there are prescribed tasks that are only available to women and prescribed tasks that are only available to men. What it does mean, though, is that we must be respectful of that headship and we must be respectful of that distinction, not attempt to blur it. It's very possible at Corinth that there was a severe problem with this neutrality. It seems that his discussion of the whole prophetic thing is the women were prophesying in a condition where they were dressing in a unisex fashion, that haircut in a unisex fashion, and were just flaunting any sort of distinction. And I think you can see that in several passages in Corinthians. But this sort of thing is never absolute because you're, again, extrapolating what might be the case, and you can never say for sure that is the case. But if you look at the various things that he's dealing with in the various parts of 1 Corinthians and tie it in with this discussion, and then you contrast it with the idea that there's some universal practice that because of the order of creation has been eternal, you'll find that particular discussion has no support for it. It seems that it's completely lacking in terms of evidence, and indeed specific commands in Scripture head in the other direction. Now, I realize I've introduced about a bazillion variables, and I've just sort of summarized a position and conclusion, so I want to open it up just for a few minutes for questions. We just got about 5 minutes or so. Yes?
You said that you don't intend to imply that there are only certain tasks available or appropriate commands to women. How do you you apply that idea to the idea of strength of women in combat? Today we're in a situation where we have women in combat. Well, and I personally disagree with it. I'm in a discussion with someone about it. How do you apply God?
Well, I don't think there is an absolute on that. You certainly have women in the Old Testament who went into battle. Is it a good thing? No, I don't think it is, for a number of reasons. But there is no absolute set down that says this is the case. We certainly, as a practice that you see regularly, I mean, it's not a normal practice in the Old Testament for women to go into combat. But if you take early frontier life in America, do you think that when the Indians attacked, all the women did was go down in the cellar and hide, or did they take up guns too? You can argue for something being a good or bad principle without necessarily doing a thus saith the Lord, and I think that's the situation in this particular one. There's nothing that would specifically prohibit it.
So. You mentioned something about the head being used as either as a term of origin or a term of authority. In verse 3, when it speaks to God and Christ, Christ and God the Father are co-equal and co-eternal, so how can one either be authoritative or an origin for the other?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's because you can't push that analogy too far. In terms of origin, it would be in the sense that God sent the Son into the world. So he's talking about the incarnation period, not about right.
In the beginning was with God, was God.
Correct. Secondly, if it was dealing with authority, then it would be, again, during the period of incarnation when he was subordinate by
choice.
Yeah. So the problem is, it doesn't really, and this is one of the reasons why that's a difficult passage, is it doesn't flow in the order that you would expect. You would expect it to be God, Christ, Christ, man, woman. But it's jumbled up a little bit there. It doesn't actually go in that order. So, again, there are a lot of reasons that we've got to be cautious about our interpretation of that. And I think you can work that concept into either of those, as we just did. So. Tom. Actually, I think, let's read the passage. Does not nature, the very nature of things, teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a disgrace to him? There's two ways to understand that. One is nature in the sense of a natural law, that this is true, that in other words, that men would always have longer hair than women. Or it might be nature in the sense of, isn't this the way things are? I mean, look around you. Don't you see men are wearing short hair and women are always wearing long hair? And it's probably in that latter sense that he's referring to here. There are extensive discussions on that, but I think that's the case. It doesn't look from nature like man has shorter hair. I mean, some men here used to, in years past, have extremely long hair. It doesn't seem to be in nature, the biology of the thing, that women would. Right, right. And my suggestion would be that he's talking about a more general thing here. He's saying, look around you. Isn't it the nature of things? Isn't this the way things are? As opposed, de facto, the way things are, not the way things are by no choice, by inviolable natural law or anything. So. Yeah. Well, first is, I wouldn't expect a pagan necessarily to care one way or the other. So it's going to be difficult convincing somebody who's a pagan, because you have no authority to appeal to. Now, you got to remember, at the time of the New Testament, even the Old Testament, there were no pants for the most part. I mean, everybody wore flowing dress-like things. But there were still distinctions made. So it's not necessarily the specific manner of dress. I mean, You know, if you were a Scottish man, would you be able to wear a kilt? You know, well, because in that culture, it wouldn't be seen as being effeminate at all. It would be the opposite. Yeah. I certainly would have a problem with the practices in the church, which is what he's talking about here. Outside the church, we have no authority to impose. We can argue that it ought to be that way, but you have no... Well, again, I appeal to the idea in this passage that a distinction should be made. And there's certainly other passages as well. The Old Testament has numerous ones that there ought to be a distinction made, and it's really problematic when you begin to blurring the distinctions. However, you know, you could say the same thing. Well, women, when they first started wearing pants, were wearing men's pants because there weren't women's pants made, you know, and it gradually became acceptable. But you've got to be careful of being on the forefront that you introduce things that are problematic into the discussion. I mean, you shouldn't be in the forefront of changing style in terms of blurring the distinction. And a lot of Christian young people, of course, would like to be. Yes? Yeah, they believe that they were already, whatever promises of the new life that were given were already applied to them. So you see that specifically in 15, but some of the other problems that lead up to it in Corinthians, you also see elements of that. For example, the idea that some married couples had stopped having sex because sex isn't part of the heavenly existence. And Paul addresses himself to that. You know, there are several things in there that seem to indicate that. The idea of dissolving marriages on the basis of now being a believer, those sorts of things that might point in that direction. But they're not thinking in terms of a second coming. They're not fully instructed in the way of the Lord either. I mean, these are Christians that have severe problems. If you read 1 Corinthians, everywhere you turn, they're doing bizarre things. I mean, there's somebody in the church who's living with his mother or his stepmother, you know, and Paul has to call him out and say, "What are you doing?" You know, I mean, there are serious problems throughout the church. In the Lord's Supper, they're turning into a feast, gorging themselves and getting drunk, and not even participating in or letting the lesser people participate in terms of economic status. So that's the same thing here. They know something of the future glory is to come, but they still are applying it now. They're not going to die. They're already into eternal life.